got it.
Ryan.
Hi, John.
How are you, Ryan?
I'm all right. How are you?
Good. For those of you who are unfamiliar to us, I'm Jonathan Chait of the New Republic. I'll let you introduce yourself.
I'm Raihan Salam of the Atlantic and the New America Foundation.
And formerly of the New Republic.
And formerly of the New Republic. Yes, indeed.
You know, I could actually like start this by bringing up how you used to be the intern and do a scene like with Joe Pesci and Billy Batts in Goodfellas, where I keep like trying to like humiliate you by reminding you of your modest circumstances and like telling you to go shine your shoes until like you fly into a rage and then, of course, this would end with me dead, so maybe we shouldn't do that.
It's actually worse than that, because actually John was one of my great mentors at the New Republic, and I remember we'd have these endless arguments because John and I bizarrely agree about almost everything substantively, but our styles are so radically different because John is very
direct.
Wait,
are you talking about me or to me?
I'm talking about you, and I'm talking about how direct you are to
okay.
the audience, whereas I'm extremely maddeningly elliptical. So I remember we would argue about Bush v. Gore, and I just remember these. You were like, yes, but most people went into the voting booth intending to vote for Gore. And I would say things like, yes, but what does that mean exactly? Or the election could have happened 2 days earlier or later.
I mean, I categorically deny having been a mentor for you or any responsibility for anything done since.
No, that's too much for too much responsibility for any one man.
I don't want that hanging over my head.
So, John, you recently wrote a column about this idea of Obama's mandate. Can you
right.
tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, I mean, this has been like sort of the first big meta debate following the election. And, you know, I think the idea of a mandate per se is kind of a silly one in the sense that, you know, you never have an election where people ratify the candidate's agenda as if his agenda were a ballot proposition that they were voting up and down, you know, health care, tax the rich, et cetera, et cetera. Nothing like that ever happens. You know, political scientists have these models that can purport to predict elections based on the president's approval ratings and economic growth, and while I think those are overstated, certainly that kind of thing, in addition to, like, the talents of the candidate and contingency, you know, predicts a huge amount of who wins. So obviously people aren't just voting on the agenda. That said, I think what I try to unpack in the column a little bit is that there's an agenda game that's always played. And both sides play it, but I think the Republicans are a little bit more effective at it. They managed to wring an agenda out of a very narrow victory that I think had less to do with policy in 2004 than your typical presidential race, and have been trying desperately to drain Obama's victory of any policy implications whatsoever. So I just try to kind of unpack and explain that game a little bit.
Yeah, it's interesting because in 2004, I mean, certainly, you know, my thinking was very similar that in the inaugural address and also just, you know, subsequent to his, you know, narrow but, you know, certainly clear victory in the popular vote, that, you know, this meant that the public had embraced Social Security reform and health savings accounts and a whole set of other things that were kind of close to the Bush domestic policy, you know. But, I mean, I think that, you know, what you saw happen is the Democrats united around the fact that actually plenty of Republicans who voted for George W. Bush were opposed to these things or were certainly unsettled by them.
Right.
And so, in a way, I think that when you're talking about this agenda game, it's not clear to me that the Republicans were actually that effective with it. And actually, maybe that's the danger, I mean, with overinterpreting a mandate. I definitely think that, you know, if you think about it very narrowly, that there is a mandate. For example, you know, there was a Reagan mandate, not necessarily for supply side, not necessarily for, you know, the whole basket of, you know, kind of Hayek-Friedman ideology that a lot of movement conservatives brought with them to address stagflation, et cetera. But there was certainly, you know, a mandate for pretty sweeping changes in 1980. And I think that you would have had that if Ted Kennedy had become president then, and, you know, you had that, you know, because Reagan, you know, was elected. But I think that, you know, movement conservatives overinterpreted that, and then the media followed, you know, kind of their decision to kind of overinterpret it and be very bold about doing so. And I think now, similarly, you have 8 years of the Bush White House and 8 years of what, you know, looks like, you know, feels like, sounds like total policy failure. So I think that, you know, the mandate is to kind of give an Obama White House some breathing room and a few months to kind of really embrace robust policy experimentation. But, I mean, which direction it's going to cut in or, you know, I kind of agree with the spirit of what you're saying, but maybe I would sort of cut just a little in the direction of some humility on the Democratic side, or certainly on the side of the kind of progressive ecology that's grown up in Washington during the Bush years.
Yeah.
That's going to want to kind of tilt him in one direction rather than another.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you're certainly right about Bush overinterpreting his mandate in 2004. You know, I don't think very many people who voted for him were doing so with Social Security privatization in mind. And if that had been a bigger part of the campaign, I think he would have lost. And, you know, I think, you know, also you had that in 1994, I think, when Republicans swept the congressional elections. You may be a little young to remember the tone of the media coverage that came after that, but the whole idea was that the American public had fundamentally repudiated the New Deal and the role of government in American life. And this was, people really had the sense that things would never be the same again. I mean, I can't overstate how dramatic people thought the change was going to be. And this really helps convince Republicans to, do some of the things that really backfired, like cut Medicare. Because, you know, well, people don't want government anymore.
We're trying to slow the growth and the rate of...
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
They were cutting Medicare services, they were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're absolutely right that there's always a danger in going too far, but my interpretation would be slightly different, which is that there's a game that happens after the election in terms of, like, psyching... I think it's about psyching up your supporters and psyching out the other side's
right.
supporters. So basically you convince your supporters that, you know, they need to be on your side because the voters want them to, and you convince the other side... voters that, you know, rather the senators and representatives, that they need to come join you, and they certainly can't block you
right.
because they'd be blocking the vote of the people.
Well, and a Republican effort to do that now is just going to seem faintly pathetic just because of the scale of the repudiation. I just, you know, the one thing I just want to get across is that
right.
if the Republicans were gaming effectively in some way in 2004,
yeah.
it was deeply counterproductive. Because the 2004 race, I mean, had it not been for delays, you know, machinations, his partisan gerrymandering in Texas,
yeah.
I think it's actually possible that, you know, Republicans would have lost House seats that time around.
That's right.
I think that in a way that kind of effective gaming can actually be totally counterproductive. So
right.
I think that the fact that maybe Democrats haven't been as good as, you know, kind of gaming the kind of, you know, is it a mandate for progressive change or not, you know, might actually serve them well going forward. I mean, my sense
right.
of kind of the broad outlines of the Obama agenda as it's kind of vaguely taking shape right now seems to be one where, you know, they've brought in a lot of folks from the Clinton years, a lot of folks who are quote-unquote ready on day one.
Yeah.
They're very interested in bringing, and you've written about this in a column as well, they're very interested in bringing big business on side,
yeah.
and to demonstrate to them that, you know, look, your interests are broadly aligned with these reforms. I mean, you see this on the healthcare side. You also see it on the environmental side, where I think a lot of firms, they just want, you know, some kind of predictable regulatory environment.
Yeah.
So they're willing to play ball. So I think that, you know, we can talk about this later, but I think that's going to create interesting space for Republicans. But I also think that it suggests that, you know, Obama recognizes the kind of the limits of the mandate. And also, like, you know, it's certainly true. Mark Schmidt wrote that wonderful piece on taxes and whether or not, you know, the kind of Norquist era, the tax-cutting era, might have drawn to a close. But, you know, the Democratic campaign definitely hedged its bets on that and definitely, you know, made the case for a net tax cut and definitely emphasized that 95% of work. Now, the Sean Hannitys of the world say that demonstrates this is a center-right country. I don't think that's necessarily fair. I mean, it's about, you know, tilting the tax code in a more progressive direction.
Right.
But I do think that, you know, but there was some hedging going on about whether or not we've entered the kind of new labor era in this country where we can just frankly say you're going to get better services and you're going to pay slightly higher taxes.
No, that's right. It definitely was framed in a more populist, you could even say redistributionary way. Can I go back? I think that what you're saying is really interesting, although I do want to make one more data point that I think
oh, yeah.
it brings this together a little bit, which is Clinton in 1992.
Mm-hmm.
And here's where I think the mandate argument really, really cut, which is that I think a lot of people were convinced that Clinton in 92 did not have a mandate. And the practical effect of that was to embolden Congress to oppose him, or in some cases to make them fearful of supporting him and his agenda, which is one of the reasons why especially health care fell apart. In a way, it sort of psyched the Democrats out of doing what Clinton was primarily elected to do, or at least what he wanted to do with his election. So that's where I think you might see some kind of repeat of history, and that's what I think people are really trying to get at here. That I think healthcare is the issue where the fulcrum of this mandate debate has really put most of its weight. That's a terrible metaphor. I'm terrible at making metaphors on the fly. But that, you know, it's to try to convince Democrats, if you try to, you know, really do a sweeping health care reform, you will be punished by the voters. That's the real import of this mandate.
I've heard so many different smart arguments about this. You know the 94 period a lot better than I do. My sense is that, you know, part of the reason why kind of that mandate or whatever you want to call it was kind of misinterpreted, I mean, you know, you had the Perot voters, and then the Perot voters were the folks who were brought back on side, arguably, by the kind of, you know, Gingrich Republicans, because they had a very kind of poll-tested, narrow set of, you know, agenda items that weren't really government-cutting-oriented. They were more kind of structural reform-oriented or, you know, creating a child tax credit, stuff like that was actually, you know, kind of very, you know, kind of small bore, and, you know, that sort of, you know, scratched the kind of, you know, kind of reformist impulse, which actually, you know, was very real when you had a population of, you know, flinty, budget-conscious conservatives who are mostly dead now.
I think that's actually that was a revisionist history that popped up. Well, that what you're saying specifically, but the whole idea that the Contract for America was important politically is revisionist history that popped up immediately after the 1994 elections. But it was not a major issue, and polls showed that very small percentages of the public were even aware of its existence, let alone...
So what you were saying is that it was just really just backlash against some of the kind of social stances that Clinton had taken? I mean, what do you think was the driver?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of things. I think the administration got diverted into a lot of arguments about identity and identity politics that really backfired, number one. I think number two, you had the failure... You had just had a lot of legislative failure, especially the legislative failure of healthcare reform. And so just like that created the correct sense that these guys were not succeeding. They were doing something wrong. Something wasn't working. And number three, you know, you just had a realignment in the South that was coming into fruition.
The party's becoming more ideological.
That's right. Yeah. The South had been slowly realigning over a long period towards the Republican Party, but it actually was majority Democratic, I think, before the 94 elections.
Right.
But then you had a wave of retirements of these sort of old Southern Democrats who sort of just got reelected on familiarity. But couldn't win on an ideological basis.
Just because I feel a little stung, because I don't like to be, you know, think that I'm easily taken in by revisionist sort of nonsense.
Yes.
I mean, I don't think that the Contract with America was something that people were deeply, intimately familiar with. What I'm trying to push back against is just this idea that it's actually more pushing back against conservatives who believe that it was kind of small government conservatism that won in 1994. Rather, I'd say that it was actually kind of, you know, very local races, kind of very small bore issues, some of which were associated with the contract. And, you know, kind of I think that, you know, so it's not so much the contract, you know, qua contract that won, but what I'm saying is that, you know, you had a kind of fairly kind of incremental agenda being advanced by Republicans rather than a rolling government back in those individual races where they won. And that's, you know, kind of, you know, hard to kind of read into, but so I'm sort of agreeing with you that, you know, Gingrich certainly overinterpreted his mandate,
right?
You know, by pursuing kind of like sweeping, you know, kind of reductions in entitlement spending, et cetera.
Fair enough.
But yeah, it is interesting because like, a lot of people say that, you know, kind of maybe Clinton made a mistake, you know, by just thinking of the surplus as an end in and of itself. And I remember those debates in 2000, you know, sort of or pre-2000 when Gephardt was giving speeches talking about how maybe running a deficit of 1% makes sense if it's in the form of public investment.
Yeah.
And now you're seeing these debates come back and, you know, putting people first had a lot of emphasis on retraining programs and on public infrastructure.
Yeah.
And, you know, I recently had the pleasure of talking to Bernard Schwartz, who, with Cheryl Schweniger and others, has been talking about this, you know, and Felix Rohatyn, these guys were talking about at the end of the Clinton administration, and it's obviously, you know, has this new salience now. I wonder, I mean, do you think that, just as a historical matter, that Clinton would have been better off had he pursued a more aggressive public investment agenda? And now, looking at, you know, Obama's mandate, do you think that it's a mandate for measures of that kind?
Well, There's a lot of points to pack in there. Number one, I think what Clinton did, well, first of all, he was in different circumstances, right? He was in an economy that was already coming out of a recession, a shallow recession that was already coming out of it. So, you know, he didn't have to, you know, he was already to the point where fiscal stimulus wasn't a really good primary consideration anymore. Number two, I think, you know, you have to separate out policy and politics. I think from a policy perspective, what Clinton did in his second half of his term was actually was the best policy, or at least he pushed for the best policy he could get, which is that when you've got a booming economy, you want to run a surplus. You shouldn't be running a deficit, you know, in a 1998, 1999 economy like we had with things just firing full blast. You should be paying down your debt for the future, in theory. And that's what I argued. I had a lot of arguments with these liberals at the time, arguing for this more fiscally conservative position. But now I think as a matter of politics and economics combined, I think Clinton did make a mistake.
Because the political economy picture, the Republicans were to spend away that surplus and
exactly
tax cuts.
Right. Yeah. All you ended up doing was just giving more money for George Bush to devote to tax cuts for the rich. And so if you just end up having a system where, you know, the Republicans get to come in office and aggressively reshape the priorities of government and the beneficiaries of government, and Democrats just clean up their mess, that's untenable. You can't have that. And basically, I think unilateral fiscal conservatism can't work. I don't think there's any point in Democrats trying to do what they did in the 1990s unless you get Republican buy-in. And the only way to get Republican buy-in is to stop cleaning up their mess, right? I mean, why should the Republicans buy into it, right? They, you know, why buy the cow when they can get the milk for free?
So this is all very salient to what the Obama kind of strategy should be regarding the tax and budget picture, right? I mean, so would you counsel sort of a different set of advice? I mean, you know...
Yes.
And also given sort of the scale of the economic downturn. I mean, so would you say that you've been involved in a lot of the kind of the rethinking on the kind of center-left regarding, you know, kind of Rubenomics, and Ruben himself has done a lot of rethinking too. So I wonder, like, where would you place yourself now?
Right. I mean, now I think, number one, you know, we're looking at, like everyone says, a huge economic disaster, right? And I mean, we're not... You know, people talked about the need for stimulus in the early 90s and after 9/11, but that was nothing compared to what we seem to be going into right now. So now you need a serious, huge stimulus in the short run, and I wouldn't worry about the long-term budget picture all that much. Number two, like I said, then you've got the political argument, which is that I think Obama just needs to reshape the priorities in the tax code and the federal budget in the way that he thinks are best, and then wait till if Republicans really want to get serious about fiscal conservatism, then you can make a deal with them. But since they're not, I don't see the reason to do it unilaterally.
That's very interesting. I mean, I actually...
What do you think? You asked me my opinion.
I've been looking at spending stuff pretty closely, and
yeah.
I just kind of reading stuff about sort of what the future shape of the tax code might be, and I'm just increasingly convinced that there is going to have to be some big ticket revenue raiser. I don't think we're going to see it in a first Obama term. I think if there's a second one, however,
mm-hmm.
I think that's something like a VAT. You know, whether or not it originally comes in as a replacement for the corporate income tax or something bigger,
yep.
or something that's dedicated to healthcare spending, I think we're going to see something like it. I think that we're just going to live in an era of, a sharply increased tax burden. And I think that Republicans, it's an opportunity for them to do a lot of rethinking as well. But I just think that, you know, I see what you mean regarding the political pressures, which is why I don't think you're going to see anything dramatic in that direction happen during the first term. And I think that actually, you know, Obama will have a real opportunity to kind of defer those decisions for the understandable reason that, you know, we don't know how long this downturn is going to last,
mm-hmm.
What the shape of it's going to be. But I think that, again, if we are in a real era of progressive realignment, I think that, you know, there is going to have to be some thinking about the structure of the American state. I think that, you know, insofar as you want to sort of devote more resources to job retraining, have a green industrial policy, have kind of a thicker safety net, I think that you're going to have to really change the way that we raise revenue, and also just, you know, kind of change the way the American state works in order to kind of... deal with the rent-seeking problems that are going to become, like, very, very potent.
Yep.
This is all very vague, because I think that, you know, kind of we don't know who's going to be in place and how long-term they're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the impression I get from Obama is that he's thinking very, very long-term, and that he's going to be sensitive to issues like that, which is to say I think that they're going to feel ownership, and they're going to, like, think about sort of tax solutions. further down the line.
Yeah, no, I think you would be absolutely crazy to think about raising taxes on, anyone below $250,000 a year. It would just be nuts.
You think it'd be crazy to do that in, like, 2010?
Oh, for the Democrats to do that? I mean, I don't mean as a matter of policy. I just mean politically, yeah, that would be suicide.
Yeah.
Suicide.
Yeah, I think, I wonder, like, because I think...
Sorry, go on. I interrupted.
It's just like, the burden on the median family is so much lower now than it was in 1980.
Yeah.
And I think that, that burden's going to get lower, assuming that, the first round of tax changes goes through.
Yep.
So I think that, I wonder, kind of how much of a kind of third rail that's going to be, if there's a perception of a tight linkage between whatever new kind of revenue sweetener you see, and, kind of new spending. I mean, you could be right. I sort of get where you're coming from, and I think that we've kind of been trained by the environment to kind of be sort of very tax sensitive. And as an ideological matter, I mean, I certainly kind of don't want to see sort of dramatic tax raises, tax increases. But, I mean, I just think that, the country's changing, and I think that, I certainly think they're going to be very cautious in the first term, but I think, kind of if they have an opportunity to kind of stay in power, and if they, kind of are less afraid, if they're less fearful of a kind of powerful Republican backlash on taxes, if they kind of distribute it, kind of in a way that, sort of might get some rich retirees, sort of, et cetera, but that's not going to sort of be too threatening to the median family, that, maybe we'll see it. But, I mean, this is like wild speculation.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think, Democrats have really figured out this tax issue, and I don't think Republicans appreciate the extent to which they have it, that Walter Mondale isn't walking through that door again.
Yeah.
The Democrats aren't going to say, well, I'm sorry, we have to look at how much we're spending and whether or not you want to spend it. This is how much the government's going to need, so we're going to have to raise taxes. Republicans kicked the crap out of that guy for year after year, and the Democrats aren't going to do that anymore. What they're going to do is say, okay, we're going to match or exceed every tax cut you want to give to the middle class and just fight it over exclusively over the tax receipts on the top 1-2% of the population, where we know we'll win. So the Republicans have no answer to that. You take the middle class tax thing off the table, and in fact, the more you do it, the harder it gets on the Republicans, because the more the Republicans realize that the tax, then you just cut for the middle class, so the middle class is paying less and less of the tax burden.
I see what you're saying. I mean, yeah. But I think that, and that's certainly what we saw in this election cycle, where the Democrats had a more generous package of middle class tax cuts than the Republicans.
Yeah.
I just think that, if you look at California, a state where the kind of you have a very, very progressive tax system, and what happens in an economic downturn, I mean, sort of when you kind of place so much of the tax burden on, kind of a group that, is certainly very, very rich, but I mean, sort of, kind of that wealth is going to kind of fluctuate with the business cycle.
Right.
And I think that, when you're talking about creating, say a Medicare Plus program, and, you're going to fund it through sort of the 3% payroll tax stream, say from employers, but, kind of presumably those costs are going to increase, I just think that, the environment is such that, what I'm saying is that I get it when someone like a Mark Schmidt is saying that, the environment has changed such that actually, you can contemplate more in the way of tax increases. And I think that, it's going to be more than a fight over the top 1-2%. But that, you have voters who are making 200,000 plus who are actually going to be fine with, their federal tax burden shading upwards to some extent, because they're more concerned about health insurance premiums, they're more concerned about traffic congestion, they're more concerned about a whole slew of quality of life issues where they feel that, kind of more robust government involvement is, going to make sense for them. It's going to make sense as a deal, which is, what happened more or less in Britain. I weirdly think that I'm actually arguing a position to your left, just in the context of what's actually possible. So I'm actually very happy for you to be right.
You Marxist. just to play off one of your points, comrade. You're correct that as inequality has increased over the last 30 years, tax receipts have gotten a lot more volatile, because you've got more and more of the income and therefore the tax receipts coming from, with a couple really rich people who Yeah, I've got people outside my window who are looking at me now. whose income tends to fluctuate, radically with the business cycle. So, you know, they have these huge, insane booms, like in the late 1990s, where they're just bleeding money out of every pore. And then it just, like, dries up suddenly after, like, 2001. It just falls off of a cliff.
Yeah.
But, you know, in theory, that's not – as long as the overall average is the same, you know, government – you know, people can't necessarily ride out those fluctuations, but government can. So if you can be intelligent about it, and if you can say when you suddenly are bringing in $400 billion more than you thought, if you can say, all right, this is the business cycle, we'll just put the money away, and then when we're bringing $400 less, then it'll all even out.
My secret agenda is that I think the right and the left have a shared interest in that. And in moving toward, you know, a system where a kind of, you know, consumption tax is going to finance progressive public spending, you know, on a variety of shared priorities.
Right. There's the famous Larry Summers line about that.
Yeah. Which is very funny.
And we're such geeks that we can just laugh over it. Even saying to our viewers what it was.
Well, I think it's that, you know, kind of the left will fall in love with it when they, you know, they hate it because it's progressive.
Right. The left hates it because it's progressive.
Because it's a revenue machine. And, you know, kind of the left will learn to love it when they realize it's a revenue machine and the conservatives learn that it's regressive or something silly like that.
Right.
But, you know, I think that, you know, but also kind of what Summers and Furman have argued is that, you know, kind of even if it is kind of regressive, you know, if the spending, you know, kind of financed by the VAT is progressive, then it ends up working out, and that's what you see happen in, you know, Northern Europe and Scandinavia, et cetera. I mean, that's roughly how it works, and it also kind of creates fewer distortions.
Right.
And it's, you know, not attractive, but if you have something like the Gratz plan where you take lots of people off the income tax rolls mm-hmm. and you use, you know, some kind of consumption tax to finance that, I think that would be a pretty attractive outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And also just, you know, kind of then you could actually have all kinds of robust ideological arguments about the way that the welfare state should be shaped and stuff like that, and sort of just going to kind of bracket the issue of whether or not we're going to become a bankrupt banana republic.
Can we move on to a slightly related topic number two?
Oh, yeah, of course.
We'll probably move beyond topic number one, but that was one and a half, and now number two. So my proposition is that you and your kind-hearted Republican reformer ilk are going to be utterly and totally annihilated, crushed, fail in your attempts to change the Republican Party.
Well,
that's my position. Now you can defend yourself.
I think it's less defending myself than... I mean, I think that, you know, that's an analytical proposition, and I guess I think that, you know, there's a lot of reason to believe that's true, for example.
If this isn't showing why you're going to lose, I don't know what is.
Well, you know, first of all, I'll make the case for Chait's position, and then I'll disagree. I'll make
so you're
the strongest possible case for your position.
The liberal's the one who won't take his own side in an argument.
I mean, I'm happy to do that, because I think that, you know, the argument on the other side is strong enough that I'm happy to make the strongest possible case. So you're dealing with a couple of very marginal intellectuals, or, you know, kind of would-be intellectuals,
right.
Who are making a kind of very idiosyncratic case that, you know, kind of is frankly kind of confusing and confused, you know, in that it's making a lot of arguments about the, you know, kind of the importance of kind of unfunded mandates, the importance of tax subsidies, the size of the hidden welfare state, stuff like that, to make the case for actually, you know, more transparency, which is to say, you know, increased explicit spending. I think that there are many kind of things that are kind of hard to get about the argument that a lot of the reformers, the so-called, the kind of self-described reformers are making. And I think that, you know, whereas the kind of tax-cutting argument is just very, very visceral, it's very easy to explain, and also people who grew up in the Reagan era, you know, who are in their late 30s and 40s, they saw it as a kind of magical elixir of political success. Of course, they saw that in an environment where the kind of median-income family of four had a much, much stiffer tax burden than they do now. But, you know, I think that, you know, kind of, so, making the case that tax-cutting shouldn't be the kind of exclusive domain on which kind of Republican domestic policy, you know, kind of exists or whatever, you know, kind of, you know, there are strong barriers to that. There are also structural barriers that you described in your wonderful book in terms of the kind of panoply of, you know, kind of movement conservative kind of think tanks and sort of, you know, other organizations, and also the kind of fundraising structure. The McCain campaign, you know, it was very funny. Doug Holtz-Eagan was kind of kvetching and moaning to the Wall Street Journal about how Austin Goolsbee and the Obama folks kept changing their tax plan. But of course, that's what you do in a campaign. You change in response to new arguments and new evidence. And, you know, but the thing is, the McCain campaign couldn't change it all that much because they were kind of beholden to a kind of fundraising base, and they, you know, didn't want to look like flip-floppers, but they also didn't want to kind of lose the loyalty of the conservative-leaning independents, et cetera, who they assumed to be very ideological and very tax-sensitive. So I think that, you know, those obstacles are very real, but the reason why I think that, you know, this broad shift in Republican politics is going to happen is for the same reasons that your colleague E.J. Dionne thinks so, which is that, you know, Republicans are going to want to win elections. And when you're looking at, you know, kind of Republicans in kind of suburban, middle and working class districts, mm-hmm. you know, kind of the Republican agenda, you know, kind of circa, you know, 1980 or circa 2004, just, you know, isn't going to have a lot of resonance with those people. So you're going to have a lot of bottom-up change. I don't think it's going to happen with a kind of, you know, a gang of kind of Republican reformers seizing control from the top down a la, you know, a David Cameron. That can't be how it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And it's also going to be very messy because it's a very kind of decentralized party. So you're going to have, you know, this kind of Christian Democratic, you know, kind of evangelical tendency on one side that, you know, kind of you might see split, you might see fractiousness on that side where they're talking about some family-friendly measures. Then you're going to see these kind of warmed-over neoconservative types like myself who are trying to make that case for some kind of broader ideological reason. And you know, so you're going to have a lot of different pieces. Then you're going to have like small business groups, et cetera, that are going to actually try to develop more effective strategies. But also what I'm optimistic about and what I alluded to earlier is this idea that, you know, as the Democratic Party reframes, as it wins over more of the upper middle class, more of the AMT Democrats, you know, and as it actually tries to sort of broker deals with big business, that, you know, could create some creative destruction in terms of those tight linkages between K Street and Republicans,
right,
so that actually you have some people in the kind of small business world who become a little bit more creative about sort of, you know, what middle class and sort of, you know, kind of conservative advocacy ought to look like. So, you know, I think you're right that, I mean, sort of, it's certainly not true that, like, sort of, you know, kind of half a dozen or a dozen, you know, guys in Washington are going to affect dramatic change. But I think that there are a lot of pieces that are going to force some creativity on the Republican Party. And I'm kind of optimistic about that.
Can I tell you what assumptions you're making that I think are mistaken?
Okay.
Assumption number one, this is something we've debated in the past, although our Blogging Heads viewers have not been privy to this debate, which is that, you know, I think essentially at its core you have control of the Republican Party in the hands of, you know, basically two groups, which is supply-siders in the business lobby, who are intensely interested in the tax burden on, and especially just more really the after-tax income of businesses and wealthy individuals. Sure. By ownership, the same thing, essentially. So their goal through politics is to achieve that end. So changing the Republican Party into something that was not primarily focused on that end would be completely self-defeating, as if you went to NARAL and said, well, the Democrats can win a lot of elections by becoming pro-life. there would be no reason to be in politics anymore. So, you know, those are the groups I think have the most influence over the direction of the party. Number two, I think you're overstating the degree to which policy positions and having popular policy positions is determinative in politics. And I think you can win elections while having a less popular platform. I think, you know, like I was saying at the
Republicans did it for a long time.
Can, and you know, it's Jimmy Carter did it in 1976 as well. It happens both ways. I think the Republicans managed to do it a little bit more frequently because elections are about
identity
lots and lots
crafted
of things.
Language. Yeah.
They're about the state of the economy. They're about whether the president in office has won a successful war or is seen as a war hero. Well, that actually tends not to matter very much. Has won a war or is losing a war or is having some kind of scandal. If the other party's having a scandal, who's the more attractive candidate? Who raises more money? These are not all equally important factors, but all of these factors matter a lot. And, you know, who has the more popular positions is just one of them. And, you know, I think most polls show that the public does not know very much, especially swing voters. And they're the crucial ones, especially the swing voters, just don't know very much about these policy positions at all. So I think a party can go on a very, very long time while having, you know, a much less popular domestic position positions and still win their share of elections.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're getting into some potentially contentious territory just because, I mean, I think, you know, kind of a lot of my view of the landscape is informed by what is perhaps an idiosyncratic and quite possibly totally wrong picture of, you know, kind of what's been going on economically over the last, you know, decade and a half.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I really buy the idea that one reason why you suddenly saw the kind of the real kind of sharp appeal of economic populist arguments. You saw a little bit of that in 2006, but
yeah.
I think you saw a lot more of it in 2008. And I think some of it has to do with psychology of sort of the kind of so-called downscale voters in the electorate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for example, people were always scratching their heads. I remember Noam Shriver wrote, you know, very intelligently in 2004 about how it was upper-middle-class voters who were the ones who were turning in droves to John Edwards and the Two Americas rhetoric, et cetera.
Yeah.
And a lot of people thought, oh, well, that's weird, you know, because, I mean, sort of, you know, why would this kind of full-throated populism? But I think the explanation that made sense and the explanation that I think has since been vindicated by some very interesting data
mm-hmm.
Is that when you're looking at sort of, you know, and this is just for stylized purposes, but the top tenth in terms of income,
yeah.
you know, and sort of given where they're distributed, you know, if you're a kind of double-income couple in a kind of high-cost area, and, you know, a higher proportion of the services you're consuming are in-person services, that is, you're consuming other people's skills, you know,
yeah.
nannies, you know, daycare providers,
right.
Eating out, et cetera. So your inflation rate has actually been pretty high relative to that basket of consumption,
mm-hmm.
whereas the folks in the bottom tenth are the ones who are the beneficiaries of, you know, Walmart. They're the beneficiaries of kind of the advent, the flood of kind of cheap, non-durable goods imported from China and elsewhere.
Right.
So, like, I think that, you know, kind of they saw this, like, restraint in their, you know, kind of inflation rate. So even when you saw wage stagnation, which you really did see, you actually even saw wage stagnation over the kind of Bush years for the college-educated, you know,
mm-hmm.
strikingly.
Yeah.
But, you know, you still saw some improvement in the consumption picture. But then, you know, when you see a spike in gas prices, which, of course, is, you know, kind of since sort of gone away, but, and then when you see kind of a lot of these other things moving, and also, you know, I mean, health insurance premiums. So I see what you're saying about sort of, you know, the policy things are, they're not like direct, and I don't mean to suggest they're kind of directly relevant the way that, well, that person's tax plan is Y, and this person's tax plan is Y minus T. So, I mean, it's more atmospheric, and I think that when Dean talked about the Bush tax hike in the mm-hmm. 2004 race, he was the wrong messenger for the right message.
Huh.
Because a lot of what people are sensitive to, you know, health insurance premiums certainly feel like a tax. You don't feel
right.
like you're getting sort of anything, you know, sort of, you know, kind of much better in the quality of the kind of service you're consuming. It's a fixed cost
right.
of leading a middle-class life. Yet, you know, that's become way, way more expensive, whereas you saw some restraint during the Clinton years. Or, you know, kind of the thing where people are really tax-sensitive, if you look at, like, property taxes. I mean, there's just kind of, like, a really complicated mix of the things it takes to lead a middle-class life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think that the future of the Republican Party, you know, kind of is going to depend a lot on how ideological the Democrats are. Are the Democrats going to want to tick up the cost of those basic goods, like a house in the suburbs, you know, for example,
yeah.
Of leading this kind of conventional middle-class life? And are Republicans going to develop some plausible plans to kind of reduce those costs? And so I think that, you know, you're right that it's not, you know, kind of like pure policy. I think a lot of it's about the narratives that you construct.
Mm-hmm.
But it's around, like, what do you see as your challenges to upward mobility? So, I mean, I don't know if that makes any sense, but that's, you know, kind of why I think the Republicans really are going to face that pressure. And with regard to those interest groups you described, I just think that they're going to have to learn to expect less. Because, you know, if the Republican Party doesn't get in fighting shape and sort of the kind of identitarian claims that, you know, kind of I think you've evoked and that, you know, Mark has written about, you know, kind of a Republican Party that's a tribal party that tries to win supermajorities of white voters,
right.
you know, kind of leaving aside the fact that it has an unpopular domestic agenda, that's obviously going to get, you know, less, it's going to be less effective given the radically changed composition of the electorate.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, kind of you have, you know, these ideopolises that John Judas and Rui Teixeira talked about are just like a bigger slice of the population and where people are actually, you know, really care about the quality of their public services and are a little bit less tax sensitive as a result.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that, you know, we're in a weird position where I think that, you know, I kind of, yeah, I kind of think I'm right, but I think that actually we're not as far apart as maybe it appears, you know, on the surface.
You know, you made the case, well, I still think you're going to be crushed by Rush Limbaugh, but I hope it's painless for you.
Rush Limbaugh's a much more effective communicator than I am, so I think that that's a very good reason to believe. Also, he's much larger than I am. I'm, as you know, a diminutive man who, you know, I could get lost in one of the rolls of Rush Limbaugh's enormous belly.
Yeah.
And actually, the next time you see me, it might actually be as a tiny brown hand reaching out, you know, kind of his fob watch pocket or something like that.
Oh, Ryan, I was waiting for that moment. All I was getting was walkery out of you. I didn't get that moment. Now we finally do. I feel like I've accomplished my mission. We should probably end on that note. I have not yet recommended your book to those who are unfamiliar with it. You and Ross Douthat have a great book, Grand New Party, which has gotten a lot of attention and very deservedly so.
I want to recommend John's book, The Big Con. If you believe that Ross and I are peddling complete nonsense, John's book is going to be kind of very kind of effective and kind of stealing you, because, I mean, I think it makes a really, really strong case that there's just kind of a structural sense in which the Republican Party is running off a cliff. I just think that our parties naturally are going to try to get to 51%, and that, you know, trying to do it purely on culture war and sort of not looking at trying to connect sort of the policy stuff to kind of the cultural conservatism is just going to be hard. But, I mean, it's an honest disagreement.
Right. My book is basically about why people like you are necessary, but, alas, have no chance to prevail.
Useful idiots, you might say. Thanks a lot, John.
No. quite contrary. Ryan, thank you so much for your time. And I'll talk to you later.
Talk to you soon.
Okay.